local news and views, and the greatest variety of music, this is Southern FM 88.3.
It is 50 years since the Deep Space Network was established. For half a century, this network has been tracking spacecraft to the moon and every planet of our solar system. Although the Deep Space Network is managed by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory from Pasadena, California, the Australian-based stations are manned and maintained by Australians. On this evening's The Space Show, we chat with some of those Australians. Now, these days, the tracking operations are concentrated at Tidbinbilla in the Australian Capital Territory. Len Ricardo is Operations Manager and Deputy Director of the Canberra Deep Space Communications Complex. Welcome to The Space Show, Len.
Welcome. Nice to meet you.
What's your role here at Tidbinbilla?
I'm the Operations Manager and also Deputy Director of the site. So I've been here for 35 years. So.
And when was this place built?
This is we originally started the place in 1966 with an antenna that was called DSS-42, which is now long gone, unfortunately. 1997, I think we retired that one. DSS-43 is still active. It's the oldest antenna in the site now.
And what are we celebrating today?
We're celebrating 40 years for DSS-43, the 70-metre antenna. Originally built as a 64-metre antenna, modelled somewhat on the Parkes telescope, but a little bit more robust than the Parkes telescope. And it served us extremely well. The first big mission that we supported with it was the Viking mission and Viking 75.
The landing on Mars.
So there's two landers that actually landed on Mars.
And two orbiters.
Yep.
Which you tracked for quite a long time.
My word. And I remember them well.
Was it very exciting when those first pictures came in?
Oh, yes. Very, very exciting. It's always the images, seeing what it really looked like. You always had this speculation, the pictures back that they made with the early astronomers where you had all these canals and everything else. It's just fascinating. Then when you actually get there and you see what it really looks like, it's a totally different story. So.
Now, in the Apollo people saw the pictures from the moon just a smidge before the people in America saw it. Did you get a sneak peek at Mars just before the Americans did?
No, we didn't have the opportunity to do the decoding that we were able to do, so we saw it afterwards. But we still watched the video feeds that come back from the States, so we actually watched the control centres themselves, and we use it as what we call a glee meter. If we're doing a particular support and there's something particular that we've got to provide to the mission, there's the reaction of the people in the control room is our indication of what has happened and whether it's been successful or not. So consequently, the glee meter is the term we use.
I remember the Viking landings. To me, it was a radio event, of course, because there was no TV coverage. Yep. And I missed one of the landings by an hour because I forgot that America was on daylight saving or something like that, and I did the hour conversion. And I watched the first one, or listened to it on the Voice of America, but I missed the second one.
Right. No, I unfortunately missed that, but subsequent activities I've been able to support all that time. So
after Viking came
Voyager. And also, at the end of 1978, we had an exciting mission to Venus called Pioneer-Venus. Mm-hmm. It was two spacecraft. It initially started off as two spacecraft, Pioneer 12, which was to go into orbit around Venus and study the atmosphere and so on for an extended period of time, and also Pioneer 13, which had four spacecraft on it. There was four probes, three small probes and one large probe. And they actually entered the atmosphere in December 1978.
Was that a tense time waiting for them to see if they worked properly?
Oh, yes, definitely, because each of the probes had been released from Pioneer 13 56 days, I think it was, before we actually got to Venus. The idea was that they spread themselves out as they left the probe and then entered the atmosphere at different points so that we got a larger 3D image, if you like, of the atmosphere of Venus. So the three probes spread out, and the fourth probe, the large probe, went directly in the line of flight.
and those probes were not transmitting from when they separated until right. just before entry. Just right. say because they were battery operated?
Yes, they were battery operated. So they had a life battery life of about 56 minutes once they switched on. Three of them stopped. One of them, small probe two, landed on the surface and continued to transmit, and it actually dumped all the data that was in the memory and then started again before it failed. So it was an outstanding success.
And what came after Pioneer Venus?
Well, then we started the encounters for the Viking, for Voyager 1 was the encounter with Jupiter. Unfortunately, we had a bad storm the night of the red spot observations, but nonetheless, we still got some fantastic imagery. Then Voyager 2 came a little bit later on, and we also had the fluke with Io and finding the active volcanoes on Io. One of the navigators at JPL was actually trying to find a star for navigation purposes, so she actually enhanced the image, and the Io happened to be also in that frame. And she noticed the funny aura coming off the space, off the moon. And close investigation, they realised it was actually an active volcano.
First active volcano found off the Earth.
Yeah. So from there on, we then started to look at Io a lot more closely and found that it had a number of active volcanoes. So it's really exciting.
So even the New Horizons on its way to Pluto had a look at Io.
Yes, that's right, it did. And it continues on merrily. We're going to wake it back up again shortly in preparations for a test run of the sequence for the Pluto encounter, which is still over 12 months away. So,
when Voyager was launched and then a year or so, or some months later, went past Jupiter, did you believe that 40 years later you'd still be tracking it?
Oh, absolutely. The expectation is that we should be able to track Voyager 2 with its larger battery until about 2020. Voyager 1 had a smaller battery, so we expect it to die a couple of years beforehand. But nonetheless, we expect it to track them at least until 2020.
And what's Voyager telling you now?
Voyager's, most of the instruments are switched off. The magnetometers are the things that we've got running most now. They're on a 40-foot boom. There's two magnetometers, one halfway along the boom, one at the full length of the boom. And we use those to detect, or to try to detect, any changes in the environment around the spacecraft, which will give us some sort of an indication of whether we've reached that heliopause and the magnetosheath.
Yeah, which is the boundary between planetary space and interstellar space.
Correct. So,
it'd be pretty exciting to know that you're tracking something that's now interstellar space.
That's right, absolutely. You know, Voyager 1 is considerably further away than Voyager 2. Voyager 2 we track here in the Southern Hemisphere exclusively. Voyager 2 became what's known as a Southern Hemisphere object only some years ago, and we see it for about 26 hours a day. So that's a little bit longer than a full day.
During the 1980s, when Voyager was hitting out, there was hardly anything in the way of planetary missions. There was a bit of a lull. Now there's almost one every few months. Is that difficult for you to keep up with all those?
No, because the funding is the challenge for us. At the moment, with the financial challenges that the US are suffering, we're not seeing as many missions being prepared. There's nowhere near the amount of money to throw at them. So NASA's looking at continuing to use some of the spacecraft that we've currently got and extending those missions to allow us to do some of the science that we want to do. Not ideally, but we're making the most of where we are with each of the spacecraft and maximising the data returns from those spacecraft at a much lower cost than trying to build a spacecraft from scratch, which usually ends up costing you many hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yes, that, for example, has happened to the Deep Space mission, which became Epoxy, didn't it?
Yes. And it continues to work. It's performing very, very well still.
So what's coming up in the future?
Well, we've got two new missions coming up this year, or three. We've got LADEE launches in August this year, which is another spacecraft to the moon. We've got a spacecraft called MOM, M-O-M, not the American MOM. It's the Indians sending a spacecraft to Mars. Their goal space to get to Mars. They launched that in October, and then in November we've got a spacecraft called MAVEN which is going to Mars. And MAVEN's goal is to try and learn more about the atmosphere of Mars and try and understand what happened to the atmosphere. Why isn't it there anymore?
And that raises another point I've sometimes wondered about. Does Tidbinbilla track only American spacecraft, or do you get tracking European ones, Indian, the Japanese, for example, with Hayabusa?
Yes, we track a number of spacecraft. All the spacecraft, though, the coordination and management of those goes through NASA. NASA actually arranges the contracts with the various space organisations around the world, and then we support them based on the schedule that's provided to us. Mm.
And you track Cassini at Saturn every day?
Just about. Not every day. Sometimes it's not in a position where it's going to produce great science for us, so we'll wait until it's going to produce great science. So as it flies past one of the moons, or the signal goes through the rings, is actually intersected by the rings, or the atmosphere of Saturn itself, then we'll do science collection. And we're still learning lots of things even today.
Now, NASA often has a little fun thing for the public where they can get their name on a spacecraft. For example, my name's on Huygens on Titan at the moment, and it's in orbit around Saturn and Cassini, and I think it's on Mars as well. do you ever take part in things like that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I put myself down, put my family down. Everybody gets their names, grandchildren and the works. So I send then the certificates to each of my grandchildren and my children, showing them that their name's actually on this spacecraft or that spacecraft going to the Mars or to a comet or wherever.
Now, I don't suppose you have much to do with the visitor centre here, but do they get a buzz out of things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's very, very exciting for them, and they encourage people as much as possible to actually put their names down. The visitor centre that we've got here is a public view for NASA and NASA's activities in Australia, and I think it's really important that we actually do that sort of thing.
And, of course, you've never touched the moon rock here.
Never. Nobody ever has. So it's nicely secured.
I came in this morning. I said, you still can't touch it.
No, that's right. You still can't touch it. Never will.
But you've touched moon rock overseas, I presume?
No, I haven't.
Oh,
no,
really?
No, that's all in, you know, arrangements. So, yeah.
Oh, well, that's something you have to do when you visit places like the Kennedy Space Center or the Air and Space Museum in Washington.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so, yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us on the space show, Len.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much, Andrew.
Len Ricardo, the operations manager and deputy director of the Canberra Deep Space Communications Complex at Tidbinbilla. We were chatting last year at a commemorative luncheon, and some of the events that he spoke about launching later that year did indeed get away. More about the Deep Space Network after this.
Online all the time, 88.3 Southern FM.
On this evening's The Space Show, we are celebrating Australia's half century of involvement with the Deep Space Network. You have no doubt met bus, tram and train drivers, but have you ever met an antenna driver? Ken Strickland is a former automation software technician at Tidbinbilla, but half jokingly calls himself an antenna driver. Welcome to the Space Show, Ken.
Thank you.
What's been your role here at Tidbinbilla?
I was a 70-metre antenna driver for many years. Drove all the antennas here, operated all the operational equipment. Basically from 1984 through till 2001.
Okay, now when you say a driver, I won't imagine someone with a steering wheel and stuff like that. What exactly does an antenna driver do?
Well, everything's computer-driven, so basically you're a high-end computer operator and technician. So it's your job to set up the equipment and point the antenna in the right direction using computer-controlled equipment and receive the spacecraft signal and process it.
Any high points in that thing? Any chance you ever got the antenna pointed the wrong way or anything like that? That you're going to admit to, that is?
I never managed to point it the wrong way, but high points, I was driving the 70-metre antenna for the Magellan insertion, which was a spacecraft that mapped Venus, radar mapper.
So that aerobrake, didn't it? Used the atmosphere of Venus to get it.
In the end, it used aerobraking as an experiment to see where they would go with aerobraking for future missions. Mm. Its prime mission was to do radar mapping of Venus. Also, another highlight, I was the 70-metre antenna driver for the Galileo insertion at Jupiter. And it was at Jupiter for, I can't remember how long, but a long time. And it basically worked with mapping the moons and doing general science at Jupiter.
Now, it was something like the insertion into orbit around Jupiter. You can see the difficulties because the spacecraft is rapidly changing velocity, changing direction, unlike interplanetary cruise when it's going on a pretty predictable path. How accurately does the antenna need to be pointed during such tracking operations?
About 30 thousandths of a degree, I think, from memory, but it's been a long time, but I think it's about 30 thousandths. So it's extremely accurate pointing. Move outside of that and you just lose the signal altogether. So it's a high-precision instrument, a 70-metre antenna, and its pointing is extremely accurate.
So if the burn didn't go quite as predicted, going into orbit,
which is
you could easily lose it because it takes time for the light, you know, the radio signals to arrive at Earth.
Should that happen, should that happen, then you probably won't see it again. That happened with an
observation
at Mars Observer. Mm. They got it wrong, essentially, and we never saw the spacecraft again. You do a lot of searching, you spend the next couple of months trying to find it, but it's rare to do so. Because it's such a precision instrument, if you're not pointing directly at, you don't see. Mm. As simple as that.
So when you're tracking something that's on, say, Mars, which is a rotating planet, do you need to keep adjusting the antenna as Mars rotates?
You're tracking Mars across the sky.
Yes.
Anyway, generally, once you're on the spacecraft, you've got your pointing correct, then it just follows a track along that line. It's rare to lose it. The only time you lose it is if it's on the planet's surface or if it passes behind the planet with planet rotation. You lose it at those times. You look for spacecraft for a long time after they disappear. You spend a great deal of time looking for them just to be sure that what you think has happened. So they continue to schedule it. You continue to track it, even though it's not there.
Well, thanks for joining us tonight on the Space Show, Ken.
You're welcome.
You could be forgiven if you have not heard of people like Ken Strickland before. You have certainly heard of their successes, though. Landings on the Moon, probes to Venus, Mars, Jupiter and Saturn and beyond. Another unsung Australian hero is former Tidbinbilla technician Peter Pistor. Right, Peter, could you identify yourself, please?
Yes, my name's Peter Pistor. I've been involved in the space tracking industry most of my life, and one of the my best areas of employment at the time was at DSS 43, which we're celebrating its 40th anniversary today. And I was a RF technician involved in quite a number of the deep space projects. The most interesting one, I think, was when we were tracking a Pioneer Venus lander, and the probes that landed on Pioneer Venus were only expected to have a communications life of around about 5 minutes. I was fortunate enough to be able to track the last remaining pod that landed on Venus for something like over an hour, much longer than expected. And I'd say that was one of the highlights of my space tracking career.
Of course, one of the difficulties there is Venus is so hot. It's about, like, 450, 470 degrees.
The pressures are so high.
About 90 times Earth's atmosphere.
Yes, and so the probes weren't expected to last very long at all, and that was totally unexpected. Mm.
And, of course, the fact that there were four probes,
you know, going to different parts of the planet. Did that create many difficulties for tracking?
Not really. Each probe was assigned to a different receiver in our particular case, and a different frequency, a different downlink frequency, which we were each tracking at the time. So they were all the signals from the various probes are all within the beam width of the one antenna, just at different frequencies. So that didn't really pose a problem by being separate probes. No.
So it must have been a great relief when those probes having been silent for so long, because they're just battery operated and they switched on almost at the last minute, didn't they? When you got the signal, yay, into there.
Yes, it was quite exciting because there was a lot of doubt as to whether we could actually receive the signal. We're quite happy when we were able to acquire the signal and lock onto it.
As you're tracking that, you obviously know you've got a signal,
yes.
But do you know that there's some worthwhile data coming in at that time? Because you're not analysing it, obviously.
No, we're not analysing it, but we were tracking the carrier frequency, and the data, of course, which is modulated onto the carrier frequency, was being processed by demodulators, which we were able to see that there was data there, but we didn't know what the data was. That would be subsequently analysed later.
So you'd have known, say, the beacon had come on, but somehow the data wasn't modulated onto it. You'd have known that straight away.
We would have known that, yes, but that didn't happen, of course. So thankfully,
Okay. So some other highlights.
Oh, I'd say there've been many in my career. I first started at the Woomera tracking station at Island Lagoon at the mini track site. This was in the early days of Sputnik, actually, and Vanguard in the American space. Space race, I suppose, at that time. And after that, I came back here to Tibbinbilla for only about 4 months, and of course that was well before DSS-4.3 was built. The antenna here at the time was Deep Space Station 42, and I was only here for about 4 months, and then I went to a place in near Toowoomba, Queensland, called Kubi Creek. Kubi Creek was the Applications Technology Satellite Station doing experimental communications work. And that was, I was there for about 4 years doing that. And I'd have to say that technically that would have been the most demanding job that I've had and the most interesting from a technical point of view. That was the idea of that station, was to develop mathematical models and to prove those mathematical models for future space, earthbound space communications. So that was a very interesting job. And after that, I actually went back to Woomera to DSS 41, and then subsequently back to DSS 43 here. And after DSS 43, I joined the Australian program for the Australian Centre for Remote Sensing to receiving data from synchronous orbiting satellite of the Earth's resources.
Yes, that's the tracking station in Alice Springs.
That's right, the tracking
just out of Alice Springs.
Alice Springs, and I think there's a second antenna now in Hobart. So that was a very interesting job. Yeah.
And it's nice there that you could actually watch the data coming in there.
Yes, you could watch the data coming in. I think another interesting aspect of that particular job was one of the ATS spacecraft. I think it was ATS-2, but I'm not sure of that. But that was a gravity gradient stabilized spacecraft. And what had happened is that it had the gravity gradient is only fairly successful when there's a circular orbit around the Earth. In this particular case, there was a failure of one of the retro rockets, so the spacecraft ended up in a very elliptical orbit. Now, this spacecraft also had cameras on board, and we could see these gravity gradient booms, which extended out for 100 metres.
Peter Pistor, a retired technician at the Canberra Deep Space Communication Complex in the Australian Capital Territory, and I'll continue my conversation with him momentarily.
The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
Now, on this evening's The Space Show, we are presenting the second of three interview programs celebrating the 50th anniversary of the establishment of the Deep Space Network. We now return to our chat with former Tidbinbilla technician Peter Pistor. His experience highlights the crossover between staff at the Deep Space Network and other tracking stations in Australia.
Hi, Peter. We were talking about the Applications Technology Satellite, which were in geostationary orbit, and we mentioned that they were gravity gradient stabilised. What does that mean?
That means that there are several ways of stabilising the spacecraft. Some of the other spacecraft were spin-stabilised, which meant that as they spun, because of the gyroscopic effect, they would be stabilised in that matter. But other experiments were to do with gravity gradient, stabilised spacecraft, and then it meant that the spacecraft had these big booms that extended out around about 100 metres, I think, and with a weight on the end of them. The idea being that when the spacecraft was in a synchronous circular orbit, because of everything was there was no stresses, that everything would stabilise out after a period of time. So the camera of the on the spacecraft could always be pointing towards the Earth. Now, one of the problems with this spacecraft is that it didn't achieve a circular orbit. It went into an elliptical orbit. And because of that, the forces involved with the orbit mechanics did not allow the spacecraft to stabilise. And, of course, the booms, instead of being nice and straight, extending out, were acting like a whip. And they were just moving around in all sort of configurations. And with the video camera on board, as an operator, we had video footage of this, and we could see these booms coming towards us like the end of a whip, and you'd almost duck when one of these whizzed past you. So eventually these booms broke off, and of course that project was deemed to be a failure, really.
That was one of the first spacecraft ever to have a camera on board that could photograph itself, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know about that. It was one of the first ones, yes, and it didn't actually photograph itself. It photographed the Earth, but because the booms were 100 metres out at times, they were in the field of view of the camera. So that was quite interesting, and we really enjoyed tracking that, even though it was a lost cause.
And how long did that tracking station... Where was this tracking station?
This tracking station was at a place called Kubi Creek, about 18 kilometres outside of Toowoomba in Queensland. It was situated on the Kubi Dam, which was then the main water supply for Toowoomba, and it was a transportable ground station. After leaving Toowoomba, I think it went to India somewhere.
And why did they choose there?
I don't really know, can't really recall what the reason was to put it in India, but because it was all based on spacecraft satellite communications, that was...
I know that the ATS operations, one of the satellites was transferred control to India. I vaguely remember, it's a long time ago now, but I'm asking, why was the tracking station in Toowoomba initially?
I think it's one of the reasons was it was equidistant, it was in a good communications view with the common satellites from other stations, one in the United States, and I think there was another one we're doing experiments. It was in North Carolina. That was one of the sites, and there was another one, and I just can't recall now where that was. But, in fact, it was only the two sites, that's right, and they were studying communication links, the FM signals, single sideband signals, all sorts of... and the effects that the Doppler effects would have on communications, the group delays, and aspects, the mathematics of the communications link were were to be determined by a mathematical model, but that mathematical model had to be proven, and that was done by experimental tests, practical tests, to verify the mathematical model. And that model was sent back several times to the United States to be modified by analysts over there and corrected. But it was one of the forerunners, I suppose. Everyone knew everything about earthbound communications, but not a lot was known about communications through spacecraft and the Doppler effects and the effect that might have had on the group delay and bandwidths and distortion of the signal. So that was a very interesting. Of course, it had a very wide band Mazer, which was the low noise amplifier cooled by cryogenics to about 4 degrees Kelvin and about minus 269 degrees centigrade. And it was very interesting working on that piece of equipment because it was state-of-the-art equipment produced by a company in Long Island in the United States, and that's outside of New York. Of course, we had to service this assembly from time to time. It would fail. We had to pull it to bits and straighten things out with a pair of pliers, basically. And this is very, very high-tech, intricate equipment we fixed with a pair of pliers.
So it must make you quite proud to know, then, that a lot of those technologies moved on into regular communication satellites that we now use every day and hardly give a thought to.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's just second nature these days. We take communications, international communications, for granted, and we don't... realise that the trouble and the research that had to go into this technology before it could come about.
Mm. So after Queensland, where did you go?
In Queensland, I went back to Woomera, actually, to DSS 41 at Woomera at Island Lagoon. That was the first deep space station established in Australia, and I think the first deep space station built outside of the United States.
And that was used in the early Ranger.
Yes, well, of course, that was some time before I came back to 41. Yeah, I enjoyed my time there. I have the dubious reputation of being, of whatever tracking station I went to, they eventually closed down. So that's quite an interesting aspect. But, yes, it's covered all of my life and... very lucky and very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time with the right qualifications. So it's as simple as that.
So why did they close Island Lagoon in the end?
I don't really know. I think it was essentially because the Canberra complex had been developing and was... It was somewhat difficult to get manpower for a remote area like Woomera. It was much easier to get staff to man the facility if it was in an established city like Canberra. So I think that was the main reason. The economics, it was also the logistics of getting things to Woomera was probably a bit more costly than in a place like Canberra and consolidate things in this area.
Yeah, and Woomera gets a heck of a lot hotter in the summer, doesn't it?
It certainly does, yeah. I have some fond memories of the place, but it was a pretty tough town as well in those days.
So where did you end your career? Here?
I actually ended my career at the Australian Centre for Remote Sensing. That was around about 12 years ago now.
And you're involved in just the tracking side, not the looking at the pictures and analysing it?
Oh, well, at the Australian Centre for Remote Sensing, that was where the forerunner of the imagery that everyone takes for granted now when they look at Google Earth, for example. But in those early days, there was insufficient computing power to be able to process this data through a computer. So we had to use specially designed hardware that had a sufficient speed to be able to process the huge amount of data that comes down with video transmissions. In this particular case, which was an Australian initiative, we actually had process the data right from the reception of the data to the end product, and that was quite satisfying because we had photographic tapes, photographic film tapes with the imagery data on them, and that, they were sold to customers, scientific organisations that use this for further analysis, and did all sorts of corrections on the data. So, that was a very interesting period, and I think that's now handled by Geoscience Australia. That's yes. Mm.
And of course, in those early days, it was first experimental, like Landsat 1 and 2. Yep. Then it became commercialised, yes. And now the United States provides those pictures for free.
Yeah, I've really lost touch with that that side of things now, so I'm not really sure what happens in that area now. But I know that Geoscience Australia still do some processing, and they're still receiving data from various spacecraft. Not only those from the United States, but the French Spot, and there's probably numerous others now.
So it must bring you lots of memories back to see the dish out here alongside us.
It does indeed. It's a fantastic dish, and it's state of the art. And the fact that you've got so much weight moving so smoothly and accurately on an oil bearing is remarkable. And I never cease to. Every time I visit here, I never cease to be amazed at the technology involved, especially 40 years ago, to produce something of this precision, something of this weight with the precision that it has.
Well, thanks for joining us on the space show, Peter.
Okay, Andrew, glad to share my comments with you.
I was with former technician Peter Pistor, just one of many dedicated and unassuming Australians who ran the Australian ground stations in the Deep Space Network. This has been the second of three interview programs in which we highlight the Australian contributions to the DSN, which is 50 years old. The interviewer was Andrew Rennie, that's myself. And I also produced this episode, the third program in next week's The Space Show. Now, as I said in last week's program, I don't suppose they have had a chance yet to call the occupants of interplanetary craft that may come up in the future. Well, we'll go out now with a version of that song by a group called Klaatu. And it has a very quiet beginning.
You've been upset with love. have ability to form and transmit thought energy far beyond the norm. You close your eyes, you concentrate, together that's the way. To send the message, we declare world contact.
Well, that's Klaatu calling occupants of interplanetary craft.